content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This is Karen Edwards for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Modern Maturity. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from various sources. We're going to start with an excerpt from No Time to Spare by Ursula Le Guin. And this first section is Going Over 80 in Your Spare Time, and it's from October 2010. I got a questionnaire from Harvard for the 60th reunion of the Harvard graduating class of 1951. Of course, my college was Radcliffe, which at that time was affiliated with but wasn't considered to be Harvard due to a difference in gender. But Harvard often overlooks such details from the lofty eminence where it can consider all sorts of things beneath its notice. Anyhow, the questionnaire is anonymous, therefore presumably gender-free, and it is interesting. The people who are expected to fill it out are, or would be, almost all in their 80s, and 60 years is time enough for all kinds of things to have happened to a bright-eyed young graduate. So there's a polite invitation to widows or widowers to answer for the deceased. And question 1C, if divorced, gives an interesting set of little boxes to check. Once, twice, three times, four or more times. Currently remarried, currently living with a partner. None of the above. This last option is a poser. I'm trying to think how you could be divorced and still none of the above. In any case, it seems unlikely that any of those boxes would have been on a reunion questionnaire in 1951. You've come a long way, baby. As the cigarette ad with the bimbo on it used to say, question 12. In general, given your expectations, how have your grandchildren done in life? Well, the youngest of my grandchildren just turned 4. How has he done in life? Well, very well, on the whole. I wonder what kind of expectations you should have for a 4-year-old. That he'll go on being a nice little boy and learn pretty soon to read and write is all that comes to my mind. I suppose I'm supposed to expect him to go to Harvard, or at least to Columbia like his father and great-grandfather. But being nice and learning to read and write seem quite enough for now. Actually, I don't exactly have expectations. I have hopes and fears. Mostly the fears predominate these days. When my kids were young, I could still hope we might not totally screw up the environment for them. But now that we've done so and are more deeply sold out than ever to profiteering industrialism with its future horizon of a few months, any hope I have that coming generations may have ease and peace in life has become very tenuous and has to reach far, far forward into the dark. Question 13. What will improve the quality of life for the future generations of your family? With boxes to rank importance from 1 to 10. The first choice is improved educational opportunities. Fair enough. Harvard being in the education business, I gave it a 10. The second is economic stability and growth for the U.S. That stymied me totally. What a marvelous example of capitalist thinking or non-thinking. To consider growth and stability as the same thing. I finally wrote in the margin, you can't have both, and I didn't check a box. The rest of the choices are reduction of the U.S. debt, reduced dependence on foreign energy, improved health care quality and cost, elimination of terrorism, implementation of an effective immigration policy, improved bipartisanship in U.S. politics, export democracy. Since we're supposed to be considering the life of future generations, it seems a strange list, limited to quite immediate concerns and filtered through such current right-wing obsessions as terrorism, effective immigration policy, and the exportation of democracy, which I assume is a euphemism for our policy of invading countries we don't like and trying to destroy their society, culture, and religion. 9 choices, but nothing about climate destabilization, nothing about international politics, nothing about population growth, nothing about industrial pollution, nothing about the control of government by corporations, nothing about human rights or injustice or poverty. Question 14. Are you living your secret desires? Floored again. I finally didn't check yes, somewhat, or no, but wrote in, I have none. My desires are flagrant. But it was question 18 that really got me down. In your spare time, what do you do? Check all that apply. And the list begins, golf. 7th in the list of 27 occupations after racket sports, but before shopping, TV, and bridge, comes creative activities. Paint, write, photograph, etc. Here I stopped reading and sat and thought for a while. The key words are spare time. What do they mean? To a working person, supermarket checker, lawyer, highway crewman, housewife, cellist, computer repairer, teacher, waitress, spare time is the time not spent at your job or at otherwise keeping yourself alive, cooking, keeping clean, getting the car fixed, getting the kids to school. To people in the midst of life, spare time is free time and valued as such. But to people in their 80s, what do retired people have but spare time? I am not exactly retired because I never had a job to retire from. I still work, though not as hard as I did. I have always been and am proud to consider myself a working woman. But to the questioners of Harvard, my life work has been a creative activity, a hobby, something you do to fill up spare time. Perhaps if they knew I had made a living out of it, they would move it to a more respectable category. But I rather doubt it. The question remains, when all the time you have is spare, is free, what do you make of it? And what's the difference, really, between that and the time you used to have when you were 50 or 30 or 15? Kids used to have a whole lot of spare time, middle-class kids anyhow, outside of school, and if they weren't into a sport, most of their time was spare. And they figured out more or less successfully what to do with it. I had whole spare summers when I was a teenager, 3 spare months. No stated occupation whatsoever. Much of after school was spare time, too. I read, I wrote, I hung out with Jean and Shirley and Joyce. I moseyed around having thoughts and feelings. Oh, Lord, deep thoughts, deep feelings. I hope some kids still have time for that. The ones I know seem to be on a treadmill of programming, rushing on without pause to the next event on their schedule, the soccer practice, the play date, the whatever. I hope they find interstices wriggling into them. Sometimes I notice that a teenager in the family group is present in body, smiling, polite, apparently attentive, but absent, I think. I hope she has found an interstice, made herself some spare time, and wiggled into it, and is alone there, deep down there, thinking and feeling. The opposite of spare time is, I guess, occupied time. In my case, I still don't know what spare time is because all my time is occupied. It always has been, and it is now. It's occupied by living. An increasing part of living at my age is merely bodily maintenance, which is tiresome, but I cannot find anywhere in my life a time or a kind of time that is unoccupied. I am free, but my time is not. My time is fully and vitally occupied with sleep, with daydreaming, with doing business, and writing friends and family on email, with reading, with writing poetry, with writing prose, with thinking, with forgetting, with embroidering, with cooking, and eating a meal and cleaning up the kitchen, with construing Virgil, with meeting friends, with talking with my husband, with going out to shop for groceries, with walking if I can walk, and traveling if we are traveling, with sitting in yoga poses sometimes, with watching a movie sometimes, with doing the 8 precious Chinese exercises when I can, with lying down for an afternoon rest with a volume of Crazy Cat to read and my own slightly crazy cat occupying the region between my upper thighs and mid-calves, where he arranges himself and goes instantly and deeply to sleep. None of this is spare time. I can't spare it. What is Harvard thinking of? I'm going to be 81 next week. I have no time to spare. And again, this was by Ursula Le Guin. And now let's move on to AARP, the bulletin. Fraud Watch, 11 ways to stop fraud now. Take these steps to keep safe and protected in 2021. Among the reasons to be glad 2020 is nearing an end, it was a banner year for scammers. Along with the usual assortment of thefts, COVID-19 fraud ranged from fake products, offers, and bogus testing ploys to ripoffs involving stimulus checks. As always, your best defense against fraud is you. While planning your New Year's, put these to-dos on your list. Some you can do right now, while others are behaviors to adopt. Together, they will help protect you and those you love in the coming year. Improve your password protection. Many online retailers, financial companies, and service providers offer dual-factor authentication. After you successfully enter your name and password, they send you a unique code via text or email that you have to enter before you can get into your account. Take it on as part of your account settings. It takes an extra step, but it's a veritable fortress of extra security. Protect your mail. Informed Delivery is a free service from the U.S. Postal Service in which the agency sends, via email, images of letter-sized mail expected to be delivered to you soon. This is a great way to monitor that nothing is stolen by ID thieves from your mailbox. Visit informeddelivery.usps.com to sign up. Check your credit report. Because of the pandemic, all three major credit reporting agencies, Equifax, Experian, and TransUnion, are offering free weekly online reports through April 2021. You will be able to determine if someone is using credit in your name and to fix mistakes. Go to annualcreditreport.com. Filter your phone calls. To help curtail the flood of spam calls, enter all of your trusted contacts into your smartphone. This way, when the phone rings, your caller ID will let you know if it's one of them. Do not answer if you don't know the callers. If it's important, they will leave a message. Even better, research call blocking apps on your smartphone and talk to your phone company about what it can do for you. Manage your emails. Start marking as spam any suspicious or unwanted emails that show up in your inbox, so similar messages will be automatically routed to the trash. If your inbox continues to fill with unwanted spam, investigate other email providers. Do a quick Facebook privacy checkup. Click the downward arrow button in the upper right corner of your Facebook page. Then click on Settings and Privacy Checkup. This easy-to-use wizard will guide you through settings that will enable you to lock your profile so that only your friends can see it, and scammers will be locked out. Vet unfamiliar e-retailers. Before purchasing something from a retailer you haven't used before, do a web search for the company's name, followed by the words scam, fraud, and complaints, in order to get a fast read on its veracity. Then read other user reviews. Also, read the About page on the company's website to find out who owns it and where it's based. It's better to know that the businesses you buy from can help you avoid any fraudulent deals. Say no to gift cards. prepaid gift cards have become one of the fastest growing requested forms of payment from criminals, and they are virtually untraceable. Take the pledge. I will never, ever, ever buy a gift card for someone I don't know. For someone I don't know. Gift cards should only be purchased for family and friends. Copy all the contents of your wallet today. This is a simple way to protect yourself from identity theft and credit card fraud. If you have copies of the front and back of all ID and credit cards stored in a safe place, you have the account numbers and customer service lines available instantly. Don't send nudes. This seems so obvious, but there have been a large increase in extortion scammers who look for people on dating apps. After a few online conversations, when your defenses are down, they ask for nude pictures. Once they have them, the extortion starts. Pay me now or I'll post them. Many victims pay and think it will go away. It never does. Stop, breathe, and ask. Often scammers rush their victims and push lots of emotional hot buttons to get you to stop thinking rationally. AARP's anti-fraud experts agree. Never let strangers force you into fast decisions. Pause, calm yourself, and think clearly and critically. Chances are you will quickly see the situation for what it really is. And the number, 1,697,934, the number of frauds reported to the Federal Trade Commission in 2019, more than 12 times the 137,306 reported in 2001. And a couple of questions for the fraud team. I was trying to call one of the major reporting agencies to put a fraud alert on my credit report, and I accidentally dialed 1-800 instead of 1-888 and got caught up in another scam. How did this happen? Scammers will often buy similar phone numbers to legitimate companies and change only one number in the hopes that you, fat finger, dial or that you use the wrong toll-free extension, like in your case. Always double and triple check a number before calling. I keep getting text messages on my phone from the parcel sorting center saying for me to click on a link, but I'm a tad nervous. Be nervous. That sounds like a package delivery scam. Crooks will often guide you to a nefarious website where they request personal information, like a credit card or social security number, to verify that a package being delivered is yours. If you're having issues with a package that you legitimately ordered, go directly to the merchant you ordered it from and request a tracking number. Now, this article is from Health Immunity magazine. Drinking in the COVID era. There's a limit to healthy drinking, and it's much less than you might think. Moderate drinking involves one drink per day for women and two for men. The call for social distancing in the U.S. meant that restaurants and bars closed. Events were canceled, and as many people as possible worked from home. But that didn't stop Americans from imbibing, maybe even a bit more than usual. Recent data from various sources have shown that alcohol sales are booming during the COVID-19 pandemic. One survey from alcohol.org found that over 1 in 3 Americans said that they are more likely to drink more in isolation, and market research from Nielsen found that sales of alcohol in the U.S. rose 55% in the week ending March 21st, the first week when large numbers of people began social distancing. So this was last March. For many, the uptick in booze sales may be a result of simple spending more time at home, or maybe a coping mechanism to deal with anxiety or boredom. But the problem appears so concerning. People at one point even began circulating a grainy text screenshot online, claiming that drinking strong alcohol kills the virus in our stomachs. that health officials were prompted to speak out. In a statement, the World Health Organization warned not only that alcohol consumption has no protective benefits against COVID-19, but that it also compromises the immune system and increases the risk of adverse health outcomes. The most important point to remember, in no way will consumption of alcohol protect you from COVID-19 or prevent you from being infected by it. The WHO's regional office for Europe said in a pamphlet published on its site. The agency shared that alcohol has effects, both short-term and long-term, on almost every single organ of your body. And that evidence suggests there is no safe limit to the ingestion of alcohol, adding that alcohol use, especially heavy use, weakens the immune system and thus reduces the ability to cope with infectious diseases. The WHO explained that heavy use of alcohol increases the risk of acute respiratory distress syndrome, ARDS, one of the more severe complications of COVID-19. The WHO also pointed out that its consumption is likely to increase the health risks of a person if a person becomes infected with the virus. As far as excessive drinking goes, defined by the CDC as heavy drinking, 8 drinks or more per week for women, 15 for men, or binge drinking, 4 drinks over a 2-hour period for women, 5 or more over 2 hours for men, experts agree that it can weaken the immune system. When people who have been drinking for decades get a respiratory infection, there is evidence they are more likely to need medical ventilation and more likely to spend time in the ICU. Alcohol doesn't act as a cleaner inside the body, but it is a powerful drug that can alter many of the body's normal health-promoting functions. Ellen F. Foxman, MD, PhD, an immunologist at Yale School of Medicine, tells Health. In fact, numerous studies have shown that drinking alcoholic beverages has negative health consequences and can suppress the immune system. Some of that research, a 2015 research review article in the journal Alcohol Research Current Reviews, established that clinicians have long observed an association between excessive alcohol consumption and the adverse immune-related effects, such as susceptibility of pneumonia. The researchers noted that these immune-related effects have recently been expanded to a greater likelihood of ARDS, in addition to potentially complicating a variety of other health issues. Overall, they said that alcohol disrupts immune pathways in complex and seemingly paradoxical ways, including impairing the body's ability to fight off infections. Another 2015 study published in the journal Alcohol found that binge alcohol intoxication, aka binge drinking, can reduce the number of monocytes, a type of white blood cell that fights off viruses, bacteria, and other infections in your body for up to 5 hours after intoxication, ultimately weakening the immune system. What about moderate drinking? Does that affect the immune system? It's important to remember that moderate drinking, according to the CDC at least, is defined as 1 drink per day for women and 2 for men. That amount is deemed safe. Anything over that moderate threshold, however, is considered excessive. Purvi Parikh, MD, an allergy and infectious disease doctor with Allergy and Asthma Network and NYU Langone Health, tells Health. He adds that it's best for people to limit their alcohol consumption as much as possible. But even moderate drinking isn't safe for some people. According to the U.S. dietary guidelines, many individuals shouldn't drink alcohol at all, including those who are taking certain over-the-counter or prescription medications or who have particular medical conditions, those who are recovering from alcoholism or are unable to control the amount they drink, and anyone younger than 21. The guidelines say there is no known safe level of alcohol consumption for pregnant women, and those who are breastfeeding should consult with their doctor. Dr. Parikh adds that alcohol can worsen any chronic disorder, such as heart disease, high blood pressure, and asthma, all risk factors for severe illness associated with COVID-19. Overall, it seems the occasional glass of wine or cocktail won't affect the functioning of your immune system, but anything past that, especially anything that veers into heavy or binge drinking, could be dangerous and should be avoided, especially right now. Now, a few brief bits of information from AARP, the magazine. Scandinavian-style coziness. To thrive in our new winter of isolation, look to dark Denmark, where coziness has become an art form called hygge. The trend has been percolating for a few years, but seems more relevant now. Mike Wicking, author of Little Book of Hygge, offers these strange yet effective decorating trips. Tips. Make a hugkrog. It's a nook. This is the place where you cuddle up with a blanket, a book, and a cup of tea. Bring nature indoors. You want to think, how would a Viking squirrel furnish a room? Decorate with leaves, nuts, twigs, and animal skins. And light candles. The flattering quality of the lighting will make you look grotto fabulous. And this article was from Rhonda Kaysen. One of the main pieces of advice during this pandemic has been to avoid indoor crowds. But in winter, it's kind of difficult to find outside activities to do. Enter snow and ice festivals. Many of these cold weather open air events will still take place with a few changes. Breckenridge Snow Sculpture Invitational, January 26th through February 7th. Oh, but I think we missed this one. Serving as a placeholder for the International Snow Sculpture Championships to be resumed in 2022, this Colorado event will feature snow art by internationally acclaimed sculptors. Here's one we could still make. Saranac Lake Winter Carnival. It runs through the 14th of this month. Masquerade is the theme for this event in upstate New York. Its focal point will be an ice palace on the shores of Lake Flower. The lighted structure, up to 60 feet high, depends on the weather, and may contain ice furniture, sculptures, tunnels, and mazes. Then there's, staged in Dillon, Colorado, North Woodstock, New Hampshire, Midway, Utah, and Lake Geneva, Wisconsin, these massive structures are erected by ice artists. This season, tunnels will be one way, and attractions will operate at reduced capacity. That was Ice Castles. Well, folks, we have run out of time today. For today's episode of Modern Maturity, be sure to listen the same time next week. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Karen Edwards, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. It is also available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have questions or comments, please call 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.